If you have a Bible, I'll do it. I'm just kidding. If you have a Bible, if you'll open up this to 2 Kings chapter 18. No, I just went back in time, just briefly. I'm back now. 2 Kings chapter 18, we know what the story is. We're going through the stories of the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Last week, we were looking at the final king of the northern kingdom and how the northern kingdom finally was destroyed, taken over by the Assyrian Empire, and all the people of the northern kingdom were displaced. Different people were put into their region there. And so that was the last that we'll see of the northern kingdom as far as Israel's history is concerned in terms of its chronological history. It's not to say that those Jewish people disappeared or they don't exist anymore or that they went to England or anything like that. It's just that they're not in that region and living out the promises that God had given them originally. So, and then last chapter, it went over all the different reasons why this happened to these guys, why they, you know, ended up facing something like this. And it came down to the fact that they were just desiring to do their own thing and not follow God's path and purpose for them. And ultimately, that's what happens. I mean, the road to destruction is the road where we refuse God's way, refuse God's rescue, and choose our own way. So here in 2 Kings chapter 18, if you're there, let's begin with verse 1. We'll read the first six verses to start with. It says, "Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel," that's the northern kingdom, "that Hezekiah," or Hezekiah, and I'm going to call him Hezekiah because that's what everybody knows, "the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden image and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it Nehushtan. But he trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor all who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He didn't depart from following him, but he kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses." So here we've got Hezekiah coming to the throne, and he comes to the throne of the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember, the kingdoms were divided, just as the northern kingdom has come to its end, right? During that three-year siege of Samaria that the Assyrian armies the Assyrian armies laid siege to Samaria. That's when Hezekiah becomes the king over the southern kingdom. And it's interesting because in contrast to all that we read about in the last chapter, and I mean the last chapter had all these, you know, reasons why the northern kingdom ended up facing judgment, Hezekiah does what's right, it says, in God's eyes, even to the point of removing the high places, which is something that the kings before him, you notice, remember, we'd seen that over and over again. They hadn't removed the high places. That was one of the things that was pointed out by the narrator each time, saying, you know, he did okay, except that he didn't remove that. But in this case, he does remove them. And it says that he broke the bronze serpent, the one that that Moses made back in Numbers 21. Back in the Exodus story, the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord one of the many times, and serpents, snakes had come into the midst of the camp and were biting people, and people were getting sick and dying. And so Moses, the Lord commanded Moses, when he interceded for the people, commanded him to make a bronze snake, fashion that out and lift it up on a stick, and it said all that would look at that serpent, all that would look at that form of the curse would be healed from the bites that they were getting. And so this thing has been around in Israel for like 800 years. And this is the first time we've actually heard about it again. You know, since that time, who would have thought? But all this time, Israel's had this shiny snake on a stick. And they've been, you know, it's turned into something, obviously, that's been a problem for them. It turned into something that they began to worship as being an idolatrous type of thing. So, and it shows how things that are good in their original context and serving their original purpose, those things are great. But when they're taken outside of their context, when they're taken into when something like that, something that was used for a specific purpose by the Lord, all of a sudden it becomes something of unintended priority in a God follower's life, then it becomes a bad thing. Then it becomes a thing of idolatry in the process. God used it back in Israel's Exodus story as a point of reference for them to understand God's desire to take care of them. It became to heal them, but it even became a reference point to the Messiah, to Jesus' coming. Jesus used it as a point of reference to himself, just as the serpent was raised up on the stick, so the Son of Man will be raised up, and all who look on him will find life. The idea being that he was going to take on the curse himself, take that to himself on the cross. And so, I mean, it was a good thing. It was a very positive thing. You wouldn't look at that and say, oh, that was an evil thing that the Israelites fell into. This was what God was doing. But they allowed it to move beyond its original intended purpose and take a place of unintended priority in their lives. And all of a sudden, it becomes a thing of idolatry. So, I mean, that's a danger in all aspects of religion. I mean, that's why religion becomes a dangerous business all the way around, and why we never want to focus. Well, you know, we don't deny the reality that Christianity is a religion. We don't want to get ridiculous about it. I know sometimes we'll say, well, I'm not about religion. I'm about, you know, relationship. And that's true. That's right. We want to prioritize relationship, but we don't want to, you know, get to the point where it looks ludicrous and we're saying, oh, yeah, no, I don't have a religion. Well, what are you? Well, I'm a Christian. Well, that's a religion. I mean, but the danger of religion is that priorities get mixed up all the time. And that's what the real issue is at stake. We don't want to be religious people. We want to be people of relationship when it comes to the religion that we follow, the worship of the one true God. And so anything, you know, and this happens over and over and over again throughout church history, even in our contemporary world. So many times we allow things to move beyond their intended purpose and take a place of unintended priority. That can be the personality of a pastor, that can be our musicians, that can be all kinds of things. The program that we may have, or the style that we go about, you know, worshiping the Lord with, or anything. All of those things, if they take an unintended priority. And we don't want to sit here tonight and think, oh yeah, you know, those churches where they have to dress up, that is a real problem. No, I mean, I'm talking about us. We could get into a position where all of a sudden, you know, our style, you don't have flip-flops. Oh, well, what's your problem? You know, that sort of thing. That's where we've allowed the thing itself that had an intended purpose to become something that's elevated in priority, and that can become a form of idolatry. We don't ever want to do that. We don't want to do that. We want to keep the main, and that's a struggle. I mean, it really is, to keep the main thing the main thing, to love God through Jesus Christ and to learn how to love each other in the process. That's it. You want to know what the mission of the church is, that is it, to love God and to love people. And that's, you know, that's a lifetime worth of effort and understanding and exploration right there. And anything else is just the stuff that we work with. And it'll come and go, and it'll, you know, lava lamps may be cool one year, but they won't be cool another year. And, you know, so you got to roll with that kind of stuff and not let anything become, and that's only for people who've been here for a long time. The lava lamps, that was a craze for a while. But anyway, so, I mean, you know, that's one of those things we always have to keep in mind, that we're, you know, it's just the stuff that we work on. Now, the name here, Nehushtan, that's obviously a name that Hezekiah gave it. You could read the text and think that the people had named this brass serpent Nehushtan, but I don't believe, based on the literal meaning of that name, I don't believe that's what this is saying. I believe that that's the name that Hezekiah gave to this thing to try to help put it in perspective, because literally it means piece of brass, piece of bronze. That's what it means literally. So I think what he's trying to say is, it's a hunk of metal, guys. You know, don't let it get you down that we've torn this thing to pieces. It was no big deal. It's a piece of metal. It was nothing. God was not in that metal. God used that to try to teach Israel something, but it has no real significance. That's, you know, that's the kind of Reformation type of king he was. He was trying to point out to them this was nothing worth worshiping. This was just something else. And so, you know, he does well as a reformer king. And the narrator even says of him that no one after him compared to him, which is amazing because his father is Ahaz. And Ahaz was the worst king that Judah had. I mean, he was like the guy that started introducing all kinds of idolatry and stuff. So this real rotten apple suddenly produces a really good seed. He has a son who comes along and does the right thing. And, you know, we can sort of imagine Isaiah the prophet is contemporary with all of these guys. He was in the royal court. He'd confronted Ahaz on several things. It's easy to imagine that Isaiah was involved in the upbringing and the training of Hezekiah. So you could see that, you know, that would have a lot to do with this, why he becomes the man that he is as he goes along. All right, so we keep reading here, verses 7 and 8. The Lord was with him, talking about Hezekiah. He prospered wherever he went, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and didn't serve him. He subdued the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. Again, in contrast, in great contrast to the northern kingdom who put no confidence in God. Remember, when things were going bad, they never turned to the Lord in all of this. Here, he does turn to the Lord. The northern kingdom was swept away in judgment, but he's prospered and, you know, militarily. I mean, he's loyal to God, and God protects him in the process of all of this. It notes that he defies the Assyrian emperor. And remember, he's in control. We talked about that a little bit last week, but the Assyrian Empire, the Neo-Assyrian Empire at that time, is controlling all of the territory to the north, all of the territory along the coastline to the west of Israel, all of the territory to the east, even as far out as modern day, right on the borders of modern day Iran and into that area. So, I mean, it's a huge territory, and little Israel's, you know, Judah's just down here, this little postage stamp size, you know, country, and surrounded by this guy, and he's standing up to the Assyrian emperor saying, yeah, I'm not going to pay anything to you. What are you talking about? I'm not going to do that. So it's, you know, he's facing hostilities right up to his border, and yet he feels strong enough and confident in the Lord to do this. So clearly his vision is for a strong, free, independent Jewish nation. He's different from any of the kings that have been before him at this point in the story as it goes along. Okay, verse 9. Now it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, the king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. At the end of 3 years, they took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is, the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. Then the king of Assyria carried Israel away captive to Assyria, and he put them in Halah by the Habar, the river Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes, because they didn't obey the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant and all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded, that they would neither hear them nor do them. So this, you know, basically was the stuff that we covered last week. This is just kind of reiterating that while King Hezekiah is becoming strong and doing well because he's serving the Lord, the northern kingdom, who was going the opposite direction of that, didn't want to even hear what the Lord had to say, well, gets swept away in the onslaught of judgment that comes. And so from this day forward, from this time period forward, the southern kingdom will also be referred to then as Israel. Before that, there was this distinction. You'd call the southern kingdom Judah, and you called the northern kingdom Israel, but now the southern kingdom will be called Israel as well as these stories are unfolding. So, as we said, we covered that downfall last time. So verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I've done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I'll pay. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Assyria. Well, This is taking place roughly, we figure if you're trying to harmonize a timeline here, and it's not real easy to do, but it looks like this is roughly about 5 years after the Northern Kingdom fell, that the Assyrian Empire, the emperor decides it's time to go after the Southern Kingdom of Judah. It's time to go after Jerusalem and that last holdout. And obviously, he's made bold moves to not capitulate and not give in beforehand. And his predecessor king or emperor of Assyria was Shalmaneser. And it's possible his name was Sargon as well, or that could have been a subsequent king after him. It's hard to tell. But anyway, this new one decides it's time to go against Jerusalem. And so he captures, he says, all the fortified cities around Jerusalem. In other words, all the cities that had strongholds and good defenses and everything, he's wiped those out. And now he's right there at the doorstep. He's out ringing the doorbell, doon, doon, waiting to come in and take over Jerusalem. And so that's, this is the prize that they're after. Now, the text mentions Lachish, which is about 30 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And why that's interesting in the biblical text is that the British Museum has a lot of the Assyrian reliefs from that period of time. And you can go online, actually, you do a Google search for Lachish and Assyrian relief, and you'll actually see the carved pictures that the Assyrians did in stone of this capture of Lachish and the Jewish prisoners being taken out. And what I think is kind of interesting about that is that they portray these Jewish men, bound into cords and everything, like wearing in their hair is all in cornrows. You wouldn't expect that so much. You think about the ancient Israelites or whatever, and you're thinking about these guys with the robes and the long flowing hair, but these guys definitely have cornrows and gunk in their beards and stuff. And so it's kind of an interesting picture. It's different from what we a lot of times think of. Now, Hezekiah responds with obvious fear in this situation. As soon as this army, this vast Assyrian Empire army is moving in on Jerusalem, and they're just right at the doorstep, he's obviously got an understandably troubling situation. I mean, this is a crisis of epic proportions for him as king. I mean, it's understandable. It's not necessarily saying it was right, but it's understandable that he responds the way he does. All of a sudden, scrambling around, trying to figure out what to do, trying to stall for time, saying that he'll do whatever that he is expecting him to do. Take whatever assessment that he wants in terms of a fine for not paying what it was he was told he was to pay, hopefully trying to, preserve his kingdom. It's hard to tell what's going on with him here. Obviously it's a tough situation, and so he's going to respond. You can't fault him for it because, he's a human being, and he's going to respond as any of us would in the face of a crisis like this. Just off the cuff, he's trying to figure out what to do. There are those who make the assumption or propose that maybe because his dad was such an evil king, he was a really bad king, that maybe he's thinking in the back of his mind, we're going to have to pay the piper for this someday, for what my dad did. Maybe this is it. Maybe we're, maybe this is our punishment. It's hard to say. I mean, there's no way of knowing for sure. Either way, we know that based on the description of him up to this point, this seems like a slip in his character. It seems like a backwards sort of step for him to take in terms of, calling out for mercy and then stripping the temple to try to appease the Assyrian king, because we'll see that that doesn't do anything. That doesn't appease anything. All it does is make the temple poorer and the Assyrian king bolder in the process of all this. So verse 17, then the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshaki from Lachish with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they'd come up, they went and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which was on the highway to Fuller's Field. And when they had called the king, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna, the scribe, and Yoah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to them. And then Rabshaki said to them, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? You speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. And in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Okay, so, in the boldness that the Assyrian king has, he decides it's time to go ahead and take his armies right down to the doorstep of Jerusalem and begin his attack. And these guys that they're listing here, the Rabshakeh is probably a title as best as we can make out. These guys were just different levels of field commanders and representatives, ambassadors for the king of Assyria, who would come out there and represent the empire to the residents of Jerusalem to give the demands. That's basically what that is. So you had to imagine the scene. You wake up one morning and you look out over the wall and just all around Jerusalem, all around at the base of the hill that Jerusalem is built on is this swarming army setting up their tents, setting up their camps, chariots and horses everywhere, and riding out in front of all of that, coming out into the open field are these ambassadors. And so, of course, you mount up the group that's going to have to go meet them, and you listen to their commands as they call out to everybody. And they're saying here, this is an interesting thing, you know, they're asking Hezekiah who it is that he's trusting in. They're saying, who is it that you trust in? Now, we have to realize that these guys are coming up there not to try to encourage Hezekiah in his faith or encourage him to trust the Lord. They're coming up to threaten him. And they're saying, well, who is it that you trusted in? In other words, how did you think you were going to defy me? Who is it that you were trusting in? Did you thought you could do this? You thought you had plans for war? You don't have nothing. You have absolutely no chance in a logistical sense to be able to defeat me in what it is that I'm doing. And you know, this is an interesting thing. We look at this. I mean, this sort of an assault on a verbal level is designed to demoralize Hezekiah and the people of Israel. It's to demoralize and discourage. And what he's speaking, when you think about it, when you look at what he's saying, I mean, it's a legitimate question, and really it's truthful in his statements. I mean, you know, any kind of chance that this guy, that the king of Jerusalem would have to try to fight against this kind of an army is ludicrous. I mean, it's an impossibility. There's no way that he could be doing. He may be saying something that's true, and yet his purpose in this is to demoralize. He's using the reality of the situation to try to tear Hezekiah down. And you know, if we look at that and we understand our enemy, the devil who's at work in our lives at all times, we can understand a little bit about him and about the way he works in his attempts to demoralize us. Because, you know, oftentimes the enemy will whisper something in our ear, whisper something to us that ends up being true. It may be true. He's saying to us, how can you have faith that God's going to save you? You're terrible at being a Christian. You're the worst Christian that I've ever seen around here. You're terrible at doing this. And you know, we may look at that. He's whispering something like that, not to try to encourage us to trust God or anything like that, but to try to discourage us and drive us into despair and to demoralize us in our walk, in this journey that we have to follow Jesus. He comes to us with words that are much like those words of the Assyrian delegates. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to try to think that you're going to make it into heaven somehow? Who do you think you are to say that you belong to the God of heaven? With the way that you carry out your Christian life, you don't do it very well. And all of that is designed to tear us down and to destroy us. And when we see that, that's the thing that we have to keep in mind. We have to realize there are voices that we hear. I know that nobody likes to admit that. Nobody wants to say, I hear voices. But the fact of the matter is, we do hear voices. Who here doesn't hear a voice in their head now and then? Who here doesn't hear their own thoughts? And who here doesn't hear something that seems like their own thoughts, but sounds a lot like what I just said? Oh, you're terrible at this. You're not a very good Christian. You're not good at this. You got a problem. There are good people in the world, and you're not one of them. How many of us have heard this? We've got to keep in mind what's going on here. We've got a real enemy at work who'll speak things to us. And sometimes he's speaking the truth. We can't deny that. We can't sit there and look at that and say, oh no, I'm really, really good. I'm awful good. I'm the best at doing this as I know. No, we have no defense like that. We can't come back. Hezekiah couldn't come back saying, oh, I got tons of secret soldiers you don't know about. Well, that's not true. He couldn't come back with anything like that. So what we have to do is realize where our trust has to be founded. Our trust isn't in our ability to do this. Our trust isn't in our own goodness. Hezekiah's trust couldn't be in his own army to get him out of this jam. It had to be somewhere else. The king is asking, where's your trust? Who are you putting your trust in? We've got to come back to that and say, you know what? You're saying I'm not very good at this. And what I know is that Jesus came and died for people who don't have it all together. Jesus came and died for screw-ups. And you know what? Since that really accurately describes me, then that means that Jesus died for me. Me, above all. If I'm the biggest screw up there is, then I'm the one he really died for, which means he really loves me, which means that I can trust him to help me and save me and bring me home. So I don't have to listen to your accusations. I don't have to listen to what you have to say because it's really, well, it's not important to me anymore. I've got other things to deal with. That's, you know, those are the things that we have to remember. Remember that the voices that we hear oftentimes are the voices of accusation that are not coming from God and are not coming from our own heart and are not necessarily originating from our own mind. They're coming from the accuser of the brethren. So Sennacherib, through his messengers, is issuing this challenge that's been thrown down ever since this first challenge was issued by the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Who do you put your trust in? Who are you trusting in that you would defy me? That you would defy what it is that I want? And when it comes to our walk with Christ, it's going to make us different from this world. Our focus is going to be different. Our priorities, our value set is going to be different. And oftentimes we're confronted with a very real enemy who wants to know, who do you think you are? Who are you trusting in that you're going to defy me? That you're going to walk in a different way? And we've got to realize that it's going to be a fight to believe on Christ, to follow the values of Christianity, and to live out the teachings of Christ in our life. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a fight. There's going to be a real challenge. There is a real God of this world who sees us as those who defy him. And so he's going to put our trust to the test. He's going to find out, well, who are you believing in? Who do you trust in? What are you focusing on? And he'll put all of that to the test. And the Lord will allow it. He'll allow it to happen so that we can understand who we are along the way on this journey. So we can better see ourselves and better see our need for a Savior who can bring us through according to his power and his grace. All right, verse 21. He's still talking. He says, now look, you're trusting in this in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. But if you say to me, we trust the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Now therefore I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses, if you're able to, on your part, to put riders on them. How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Well, okay. We understand from what Rab Shaki says here that Hezekiah made an alliance with Egypt, clearly just kind of like the king of the northern kingdom had done as well, thinking that since Egypt was one of the last holdout nations against the Assyrian onslaught, they thought, well, if we can team up with these guys, maybe we stand a chance. Maybe we can do something. So the delegate here mocks that, showing that, you know, trying to show the Jerusalem delegates that they have no fear of Egypt. We, you know, Egypt, that means nothing. You're going to trust in that, but that's going to end up, you know, causing you more pain than you ever thought. And we know from the book of Isaiah that Isaiah the prophet tried to talk Hezekiah out of this. And you can look that up on your own at different times in there. It's Isaiah 19, and he also warns him in Isaiah 20. Most notably in Isaiah 31-5, he makes statements like, woe to those who walk down to Egypt and haven't asked my counsel, God's counsel. The strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame, is what Isaiah said to Hezekiah. And here it's certainly coming true. The strength of Pharaoh is something that ends up being a source of mockery to these guys. So again, he is attempting to demoralize Hezekiah and Hezekiah's people and demoralize their will to resist him. And even by second-guessing his response, because he says, well, if you're going to say we're going to trust in the Lord, he basically is saying to them as though he's in an elevated position of knowing the Lord better than they are, says to them, well, but, you know, you can't say that because even Hezekiah has taken down all the high places and told you that you can only worship here in Jerusalem instead of spreading out other places where you could worship the Lord in other venues and other ways. He's made the whole thing limited and narrow. He said it all comes through here, all comes through Jerusalem. So obviously God's going to be mad at you. And clearly that's his misinterpretation of what was going on. The narrator rightly assesses this as being obedience on Hezekiah's part. He took down something that was idolatrous. But to the pagan nations, they looked at it and said, well, man, you guys are getting awfully narrow here. You're getting awfully limited in what you can do. God's probably mad at you guys because you're doing everything just through this one thing. You know, instead of saying there's many roads that lead to heaven or whatever, you're saying it all comes down through Jesus. That's crazy. God's probably against you people for all your narrow-mindedness and all this Jesus centrality stuff. That's nuts, man. And so that's, he's trying to, you know, trying to get them to back down based on that, to try to elevate his position of understanding of the Lord over top of his. And then he demands a pledge from them. And that all of a sudden brings it back into focus. It reminds us why he's here in the first place. It reminds us why these delegates are standing out there outside of Jerusalem. Instead of sending the armies in to start fighting right away and lay siege there, they send up delegates to begin talking, and all of a sudden we remember, oh, that's right, they want Israel to surrender. They don't want to fight. They don't want to expend all the energy and the manpower and the blood that's necessary to do this fight. They'd rather these guys just surrender and get it over with. That's what they'd rather be able to see happen. We think about that, and I guess that's just kind of an interesting thing to me as I ponder that little detail, because I realize, you know, by and large, when we think about the struggles that we have, the spiritual warfare that goes on, the wrestling matches that we have with our enemy, you would say that at least 90%, or maybe more, maybe my thinking's off on that, but at least 90% of any real confrontation or battle that we have with our enemy is all up here in the mind. It all has to do with thoughts. It all has to do with words. It all has to do with reactions and our reactions to different thoughts or different attitudes or different emotional things that could be presented to us. You know, you think about that. It makes me wonder about that. It makes me wonder, maybe our enemy doesn't really want any kind of real fight with us. You know, it would be a lot easier for him if he could just get us to give up right off the bat. Just say, hey, you're a terrible Christian. And we go, oh, you're right, I quit. And then he doesn't have to mess with anything more. But if we say, yeah, you're right, I am a terrible Christian, but so what? Jesus is a wonderful Savior, and I'm just going to keep following him and serving him and loving people and doing what it is that the Lord has called me to do and live out. Well, then he's got a fight on his hands. Then he's got to find different ways to work against us. But as I think about that, I think that a lot of the struggles that we have all take place up here in our thoughts and our minds and how we're reacting to things. That's why it's so important for us as believers to get in the practice of beginning to live a day at a time, to live right here in the moment that we're in. Because right here, right now, everything is all right. The Father is here with us. We're at one with him. Everything is fine. It's all the stuff that we are thinking about in the future that needs to get done or that could possibly happen. That's the place where he loves to keep us. He loves to keep us out there in the what ifs. What if this happens? What if that's going to happen? What if this person said, or what did that person say? Or back in the past, oh, why did I do this or why did I do that? Both areas that we have no control over. There's nothing we can do about that anymore. But if we live right here, right now, and thinking on what Philippians tells us, thinking on whatever is true, and what do we know in a situation that's true? What do I know that's true here? If you really start thinking about what's true and not what could be or what's speculatively true or what was true back then, but thinking about what's true right now, you'd be amazed how many things begin to strip away that you realize, well, that's not really a thing to think about, or that's not a problem, and that's nothing. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves in a very peaceful place because we realize right here, right now, everything's all right because the Father's here and he loves us. So it's an important thing to realize that just like these ambassadors came trying to employ psy war against them, you know, psychological ops. It was all designed to demoralize them so that maybe they could get them to surrender without a fight. And then he finishes up by trying to undermine Hezekiah's standing with God, saying, in essence, if God hadn't been with me, how could I have taken out all these other armies? How could I have done everything, you know? And he basically is saying to them, you need to face it. God's on my side in this situation, which, of course, every army says, God's on my side. Nazi Germany, on their belt buckles. Every soldier that fought for the armies of Nazi Germany had inscribed on their belt buckle, God is with us. Because every army believes God is with them. And he's just emulating that thing that's been all the way through. He's trying to say to him, God's not on your side. He's on our side. Clearly he's on our side. Because look how many people we got. And look how much has been happening. Look how nobody stands before us. Okay, verse 26. And then it says, then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, Shebna and Yoah said to Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it, and don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. But Rabshakeh said to them, has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you? Okay, so these delegates try to get the Assyrians to quit speaking in Hebrew, the native tongue around there, because everybody up on the wall is listening to this, and you know, you can probably imagine the noise of all the people beginning to talk to each other and stuff. Well, what are we going to do? What's happening? What is this all about? And so the delegates are out there saying, Ixnay on the Hebrew, hey, would you speak to us in Assyrian? We'd understand your native tongue. Let's hash this out. And of course, you tell a bully to stop doing something, and what's he going to do? He's going to do it all the more. Oh, well, nanny, nanny, nanny. And he takes off talking, you know, even louder. And I guess I'm kind of jumping the gun on that, but I mean, that's the whole concept there. And so he's trying to get everybody. He wants the whole population discouraged enough to force the leaders to surrender. That's the whole idea. So he heaps everything on, describing the conditions under a siege, how bad it's going to be, what you're going to be reduced to eating in all of this. So verse 28 then. Then Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew and spoke, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Syria. Thus says the king, don't let Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you from his hand, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. The city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't listen to Hezekiah. For thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me, and every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one drink the waters from his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive groves and honey, that you may live and not die. But don't listen to Hezekiah, lest he persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations at all delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim and Hena and Ivah? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? But the people held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, don't answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Yoah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of Rabshakeh. Okay, so he's turned directly towards the people, and he's not just speaking this now to the delegates, but he speaks this to all of the people to try to strike fear into their hearts. And he goes through all of these things, heaping on all of this stuff, you know, getting them to doubt their leaders. Don't listen to Hezekiah. He's leading you wrong. He's not talking right. And if he tries to tell you to trust in the Lord your God, well, you need to look around at the other nations, because look what happened to them. Did their gods deliver them in their time of crisis? And did their gods come? Even you're the same God that the Samaritans were supposed to be worshiping was your God, and he didn't deliver them from all of this. And, you know, the whole idea that he's developing here is that you, if you listen to Hezekiah and trust in this God of yours, are going to fall to ruin. But if you follow me, if you listen to me, if you come over to my land, oh, you'll have vineyards and honey and all of the wonderful things that you want and peace, and it'll be just like this, but it'll be different. It'll be my way and not God's way. And of course, again, that's the perfect type of what the enemy is always offering. This doubt, this constant pestering doubt that if we follow the word of the Lord, that it's going to lead us to more and more problems, that there is some solution that we could have, some sort of life that we could possibly have built in this world, in the fallen ruins of this place. And of course, that's the whole thing that the enemy does to us to try to distract us and draw us away. But in this story, as far as I'm concerned, you could almost insert in there the word oops. Because by going that far, by all of a sudden directing this and saying, and the God of Israel is not going to save you, you could almost hear heaven shudder at that point. It's just almost like saying, oh, I see how this is going to work out now. The Assyrians are going to get ruined in the process of this story because you're not going to stand up and defy God this way. It's one thing to get the people shaken and who aren't following their Lord, but when they're following the Lord, their God, and you attack them and the Lord watches over those that he loves like his children, and then you begin to attack the Lord himself, well, we could just say oops and leave it at that. So their response is wonderful. The people on the wall, everybody around, their response after this guy gives this speech, he's standing out there calling out as loud as he can, and in his mind he's thinking, this will get him. Oh, this will get him. They'll be screaming, they'll be shrieking with fear when I'm done speaking my words. And when he's done and his voice echoes off the wall, there's just this thin silence that just smothers the desert all around them, and everybody stands there looking at them. They're probably thinking, oops, in their mind as they're standing there, realizing that this is the accusation of an enemy, but there is a God who's much bigger than him who's going to be at work. I love it that they listened to this. Hezekiah said to them, don't answer, don't answer. Don't answer a word. Don't even take it up. We don't have to bother with his threats and his condemnation and the picture that he paints. We don't have to bother with that at all because we're going to a different way. We're going to go to a different source. And we'll see, and I'll just kind of jump the gun here, but in verse 1 of chapter 19, so it was when King Hezekiah heard it, that he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and then finally the last sentence there is the perfect sentence to finish this off. And he went into the house of the Lord. Oh man, this is going to be a good story. I can tell you right now, this is going to be great. And so this is the thing, when he's confronted with all of these things, the lessons that we can learn from this is, you know, when condemnation comes to us, and it doesn't matter what source, whether it's some voice that we're hearing internally, whether it comes through some human agency, we realize, like Christ, we don't have to say a word. We can stay silent because Jesus has already gone ahead of us in all of this. He's borne all of that for us. We've got a God who cares about us, who loves us, who lavishes his grace on us. If we're to be defended, let's let God do that. We don't need to raise our voices. We don't need to make a fuss. We don't need to shout. We can stand in silence. Let that voice of the accusation go ringing off the walls. We don't have to utter a sound. We know God's the one who's in control, and we can trust him. So, Father, we just thank you so much for your word. We thank you for these stories and how they encourage our hearts as we see how you worked in the hearts and the lives of the people who've trusted you. Help us to be that way, Lord. You know our frame. You remember that we're made of mud. You know our end and our beginning. And we just trust you, Lord. Lead us on step by step. When we hear your voice calling in a distance, guide our steps to you to walk according to your ways and to live out your teachings in our lives. We pray that you do this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.